Hello, and welcome back to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff. Today we're going to talk with the third member of the team that went to South Africa, Fred Johnson. Fred is the husband of Altheta Johnson. They're both from Brooklyn, New York. And he's going to talk about his experience being a caregiver, living with and helping to care for a paraplegic for more than 20 years. Picture a bright young couple, very physically active, runners, tennis players, and upwardly mobile professionals. She's a nutritionist. He's a trainer for a nonprofit in New York. And all of a sudden, finding that the happily ever after that they thought they had signed up for was going to come out different. It's been a big gear shift for them. They've done it with as much grace as I think any of us could pull. And today you're going to hear more of the story. We'll be back in just a minute with Fred Johnson. This program is brought to you as a public service by the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance. Read about us on our website at powerfulpatient.org. We will be glad to answer as many of your questions as possible, and we now have an answer line where you can call in and record your question to be played on the air. If we use your question on the air, we will send you one of the CDs that we use here. And again, the website is powerfulpatient.org. And now I'd like you to meet my friend Fred Johnson from Brooklyn, New York.
So how are you doing?
Okay. I'm fine.
When we were together in South Africa, you spoke at the meeting and you made such a very nice speech. I wondered if you could share some of those thoughts with us, too, about being a caregiver and living as a partner with VHL for so many years.
Okay. I hope I can get my head around that.
Tell me a little bit about meeting Altheta and how things were before all this medical stuff came up, and then how your life shifted.
Okay. I guess I would be yelled at for not getting dates correctly, but
no, that's okay.
We met several years ago. I'm in the early to mid-80s, and I think our meeting was pretty much normal. I actually was in a graduate course with her sister and lived in the same building with her sister.
Uh-huh.
And so we were, I was acquainted with her sister before I was her, and then we met on a couple of occasions, and then on one occasion we met through another mutual friend at a party, and that's when we begin to talk, and sometime after that we just ran into each other again in the building and had made arrangements to meet, and I was on my way somewhere out of town, and we decided we'd get together upon my return, and we did. And I think after that meeting we kind of spent the next several days. I mean, we saw each other for a number of days after that, but things progressed, and I think it was pretty much of a normal courtship, and after a couple of years decided to get married. And I think our marriage was fairly normal. We moved into an apartment and then into a house, and we were very excited about the house, and it so happens that shortly after getting married, we got the house, and I got a new job, and things seemed to be coming rather rapidly. And a couple of years later, and Altheta also had a new job that she only was on for 2 years, maybe two and a half, and she started developing some pains walking. Problems walking. Prior to that, she did a lot of jogging, marathons, and so forth. And her problems walking became more and more pronounced, and we began seeking out physicians to look at the problem. And no one seemed to know what the problem was. acupuncture and chiropractors.
Right.
I think we saw two different chiropractors, one of which she saw several times. And they all professed to be able to help her, but none did. Finally, she saw a neurosurgeon who said, well, you need an MRI. And after the first MRI, he said, well, you need to see another neurosurgeon immediately and have him look at these pictures. And when she did, they were, he hospitalized her immediately and said, we need to take a closer look and possible surgery. And it was after that first surgery that a diagnosis was made of VHL. And during that first hospital stay, she actually had two surgeries, the first of which lasted for many hours. But that hospital stay turned into a year, just about.
Mm.
After the surgery, she had a surgery, and then days later, she had a second surgery. And she stayed in the intensive care unit of the hospital for probably 30 to 60 days, and then in the rehab section of the hospital for 9 months or more.
Goodness. So this is 20 or more years ago.
Yes.
These days it probably would have been less hospital and more rehab or something.
Yes. Well, but the rehab was in the hospital.
Uh-huh.
So the rehab unit was, you know, another section of the same hospital. This was Beth Israel Hospital in Manhattan on 14th Street.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were trips back and forth to the hospital every day. And she had physical therapy every day. And she finally got to a point where she was using a walker. I think at that point her life had changed drastically.
Mm-hmm.
And upon, she saw a social worker there, and upon leaving, the social worker talked to me, and as I mentioned before on many occasions, I haven't forgotten, she said to me, are you ready for your wife to come home? And I didn't really, I guess, understand her question in total. I said, well, yes, I'm as ready as I can be, knowing that, well, I can't do anything else to prepare myself except that she has to come. Mm-hmm. And at that point, they also had assigned a home care attendant, which was also something for me to get used to have someone coming every day and spending 12 hours or so in your house. And at first they offered 24 hours, and we both did not want that, so we opted for the 12 hours, which turned out to be good. Yes.
Yeah, so this surgery resulted in her being unable to walk at all, or reduced function at this point?
It was reduced function at this point, but extremely reduced function. She walked with a walker, and she used the walker to do everything. So she there was no independent walking.
Mm-hmm.
She could stand, and she could move from room to room. She couldn't get on that walker and walk for a quarter of a mile.
Right.
So
she needed someone to stabilize her all the time, or...?
No, she could stand up, and she could move from one room to another.
Mm-hmm.
She could even go up and down a flight of stairs at that point.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. And in fact, we lived in a house that was a stoop of stairs to get into, and then a living room and kitchen, and then another flight of stairs to get up to the bedroom. And at that point, she was able to get up to the bedroom. Going up, she needed assistance. Coming down, she could do on her own, which she did for several months because she was home, and I would leave early in the morning. She would get up with me, and I would assist her in bathing and getting herself together so that she could come downstairs. And she would wait for the attendant to arrive, and then the attendant would further assist her.
Mm-hmm.
And she would get up to even open the door for the attendant at that point.
So you guys went from a relatively active lifestyle, doing a lot of tennis and running and marathoning and fixing up your nice new house and all that sort of thing, to getting your wings clipped pretty bad.
Yeah, and not realizing how much it really changed things for us.
And it was one thing while you were visiting her in the hospital for the best part of a year, but then, as you say, when they said, are you ready for her to come home, it wasn't just about, do you want her to come home? It was also, is the house ready, or are you ready to accept the responsibility and the work that this is going to entail?
Yes, and I said yes, but I'm not quite sure I was. But over the year and years, I guess I have become ready.
Yeah. Well, you're doing a wonderful job, but I know that it's a huge strain sometimes. And as you said, just learning, just having someone else in the mix in your house for half the day, it has to be a big change as well.
It was a huge change, and that first home care attendant, I think, was probably a blessing to us. It's someone that automatically, for my sensitivities at the time, we trusted 100%.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a young woman who we actually met in the hospital, and she actually had came to the hospital a couple of times before she actually left, and we sort of bonded with her. And she was just very, I just felt very good about her in terms of trusting her and having her come in and eventually, you know, just giving her keys to the house. And that was a very good thing.
Because you were going off to a full-time job, at
yes.
least a full-time job, with a good bit of business travel thrown into it too, as I recall, right?
Yes, and at the time, her sister, one of her sisters lived in the neighborhood, and her mother was very mobile, even though she lived, her mother also lived in Brooklyn, not in the neighborhood, but in Brooklyn, and she was mobile enough to come by and assist. So there was a lot of family support at that point.
We're speaking with Fred Johnson from Brooklyn, New York, about his experiences over the last 20 years as caregiver for his wife. Althea has von Hippel-Lindau disease, and she was diagnosed with multiple tumors of the spinal cord in the 1980s. They were able to successfully remove the biggest tumors, but there was a fair amount of damage to the spinal cord done through that surgical experience. Stay with us now. We'll be back and speaking some more with Fred when we come back after this message. Please go to powerfulpatient.org on the internet. You will find the program guide for this show with more information about the people we've spoken with, the websites that we mention, and any other background information. And as always, we would appreciate your support. Please donate to the Cancer Research Fund and bring us back another day. Stay with us now, and we'll be right back. Please donate to the Cancer Research Fund. We are putting together this year's grant recipients, and we'd love to have enough money for one more grant. So please help, and we'll be right back with more with Fred.
And then there was more surgery and more reduction in function.
Yes, we got accustomed to things with her using the walker, and this was for at least a year. And she got a bit stronger, and as I said, she used to come downstairs by herself and go upstairs with some assistance, but basically by herself, but with someone there, just in case.
Mm-hmm.
And we've never had an incident on the stairs during the time she had the walker of her going up and down. But a year after that, she began to develop more problems walking and pain. And of course, she was being screened occasionally, and they found more tumors. But of course, after the first and second surgery, we knew that all the tumors had not been removed. Mm. There were still more tumors in her spinal cord.
Right.
And so the diagnosis was that she needed an additional surgery. And we went back to, took us back to Beth Israel. And after the next surgery, she needed more rehabilitation, but this time the rehabilitation could not be in the hospital. They designated that it would be more extensive, and she was sent to a rehab hospital, which was Goldwater Memorial Hospital on Roosevelt Island, and she spent about 14 months at Goldwater. And this was a major adjustment for her, because Goldwater is not a, it's not a Beth Israel hospital setting. It's a rehab hospital. It's also a hospice, and they house a lot of people who live there and who will never leave.
Mm.
And you do not have, like, rooms for one or two people. What you have are wards, and you have lots of people on the ward. So it was...
So crises happening around you.
All the time. And you're not alone. There's not very much privacy.
Mm-hmm.
And you see patients who are with various... degrees of physical disabilities from various things, not from cancer or VHL, but from strokes, gunshot wounds, falling downstairs, jumping out of windows, etc., mm-hmm. muggings, you name it, drug use. And so it was a very diversified population.
Well, and it sounds like it was probably a fairly depressing environment as well.
It was. It was. And so daily visits became more important there. Meals became more important in the hospital. You expect hospital food. But Beth Israel was in the heart of the East Village of Manhattan, where... once you can get outside, or just if you can bring food from outside, you have lots of options. But Goldwater is sort of isolated. It's on Roosevelt Island. It's across from Manhattan Island, and you're surrounded by water. It takes a bit to get there, and there are limited stores.
Not so many restaurants.
No, there was, I think, one restaurant at the time on the island.
Wow. Yeah, I remember my husband was in an extended hospital stay once in Manhattan, and my job was to bring food from the deli. So, you know, if you can do stuff like that, it adds something to the atmosphere, but when there aren't very many choices around, that's pretty hard. Yeah. So it was not only a difficult change for her, but it also was a difficult shift for you.
It was, and at the time, while I was working for Global Ministries, and my days consisted of morning classes and probably somewhere between 12 and 1 o'clock in the afternoon, I would leave work and go to the hospital and spend the afternoon, and then go out, get dinner, and bring it back at around 4 or 5 o'clock. and stay somewhere into the evening to 7 or 8,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes later. But around that time, they would kind of close down the ward. I think you were definitely supposed to leave by 9. There were times when I stayed later, depending on what was going on. But that routine was pretty much standard for the 14 months that she was there.
So you were able to work half days?
Basically half days. I started very early in the morning. I probably
right.
got to work about 7. Started classes at about 9, and the classes would end by 12. And so by 12:30 or 1 o'clock, I'd probably be on my way
mm-hmm.
to the hospital most days.
So you probably got in 2/3 of a working day. But nonetheless, it takes a lot of understanding on the part of an employer to make that work as well.
Absolutely. I was fortunate there.
Right.
So she stayed there for 14 months, and during that time, she became accustomed to the wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
She was not able to use the walker anymore. And finally, after extensive rehabilitation, and she was in physical therapy every day, she was able to come home, and now things would be extremely more difficult. We no longer had the same home care worker that we had before, because now it's a year later, and
mm-hmm.
she's gone off to do other things by now, but we had someone else, and once again, it was for 12 hours a day. And for a time, my work schedule did not change. I would still come home fairly early just to see what was going on, but now it became an issue where she could not go up and down stairs because she wasn't using a walker. So
right.
now the issue became that we have to live on one floor in the house as opposed to 2 or 3 and take her time going up and down steps. Steps was no longer an option. So when she was in the house, she was confined to the one floor, the living room, dining room, and kitchen floor. And so we more or less created a bed.
Because it was 6 or 8 steps to get from the street to the first floor of your house, right?
Probably about 10 steps. It's a stoop. And,
okay.
And there was always assistance needed to get into the house now, and that assistance was usually 2 people, not just 1.
Mm-hmm.
It was, although I did get in and out of the house by myself on occasion, because you can, while she was in Goldwater, I did learn some things about manipulating a wheelchair up and down the steps. However, those were things, kind of acrobatic things that I saw people do in wheelchairs, and I wouldn't try them, but for the 8 to 10 steps that we had, I would tilt the chair back and roll up one step at a time or roll down one step at a time on occasion.
So more or less like you would do with a baby carriage, only the person that you're wheeling up is a great bit deal heavier than a baby.
Yes. And you can't let go. And you can't
right. It would go crashing down into the street.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
I never had any problems doing it. However, after a while, we got into a routine, settled in on one floor of the house, and Althea developed a schedule, and she would still go out. She became a patient of ICD, the International Center for the Disabled,
mm-hmm.
and she would be picked up at least twice a week. And by accessoride or another mobile vehicle, and the driver then would have to do what I did in terms of taking her down the steps mm-hmm. or bringing her into the house. Most of the time I tried to be home by the time that she might come back, but on occasion I might not have been. So mm-hmm. those drivers had to do what I did. They'd have to tilt the wheelchair back and take her up 8 steps or down.
So they're trained and able to do that?
Yes, most of them are.
Right. Or at least if there were two of you, then the two of you were able to do it together.
Yes, and with two people, it's much easier than with
right.
one, and much safer and secure.
Right. Now, obviously there are issues for the patient, and the patient's burden is very heavy, but we also need to worry about taking care of the caregiver, because now you've been doing this for 20 years, right?
Yeah.
And what kinds of things have you learned about how to keep yourself healthy, both mentally and physically, because of all these additional strains?
Well, I just learned that once you have to be physically in shape. So I've always been a person who enjoys athletic activity, and I've gone from paddleball to tennis, and earlier on in my 30s from basketball. But I'm always looking for some physical activity to involve myself in. Once it was swimming, and now I'm doing a lot of walking these days. I haven't given up tennis, but I cannot do that as often as I'd like to stay in shape. Also, some light calisthenics. So staying physically fit is good.
Right, because part of your job is weightlifting and other kinds of gymnastics, as you've described here, that there's a physical aspect to living with a paraplegic and helping to support her.
Yes.
Just getting in and out of the car or in and out of the house with a front stoop like that is a physical challenge.
Yes. And then going back to what the original social worker said, that became an issue even though, this is going back almost 10 years, I was able to physically deal with going in and out of the house and the steps. Over a period of time, that kind of wears on you. And mm-hmm. there was other people involved, and as I said, there was one driver who actually dropped, let the wheelchair go for the last 3 or 4 steps once.
Why?
And so she did experience, she didn't fall out of the chair, but the chair did bounce down 3 or 4 steps before he could catch it again. And that was at the last 3 or 4 steps. Had it happened at the top, then
right.
he wouldn't have been that fortunate.
Right.
Or her. But after doing that for a period of time, it wears on you. So if possible, you entertain the notion of trying to do something where you don't have to do that. And plus, as I said, we did live in a sort of a triplex, and she never saw the third floor after the first surgery. She never went up to the third floor. Mm-hmm. And that's where our washing machine was, so I did all the laundry at that point. But we began to entertain the notion that maybe we ought to leave this house, although we hadn't been there for a tremendously long period of time, about approximately 13 years. And 8 of those years, she was physically disabled, and we lived on that one floor for a number of years.
So the house of their dreams is now not the ideal house for someone who's living in a wheelchair, and they begin to think about relocating. Stay with us now, and right after these messages, we'll hear more from Fred and about the adaptations that he was able to make in their new home.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Right, so you had a three-story brownstone sort of house with shared walls, right, in Brooklyn. And she was living on one of those three floors, but then you were able to relocate to and rehabilitate another house. So now you have an elevator, right?
Yeah, so we bought a smaller house and did a gut renovation. It's a two-story house, but it has an elevator, and so both floors are accessible. The backyard is accessible. She never used the backyard in that house as well, the mm-hmm. other house, because mm-hmm. you had to go down a flight of stairs to get to it. So now things are a lot better in terms of accessibility. She can get up and down by herself. She also has a motorized chair, and she can move around on the floor by herself.
So this gives her more independence, but it also gives you more independence as far as that goes, and also reduces the physical burden on you.
Yes.
Yeah. And after all, you're young 60s now, right? So you deserve a break. Now, sometimes as people go through long-term illnesses, it's kind of hard to keep spirits up. And I've seen the two of you really work at negotiating things all the time. I wondered if you wouldn't mind sharing some of what you've learned about how to keep your spirits up, keep the atmosphere as clear as possible so that people don't begin to harbor resentments and such about each other.
Well, I don't know that I'm I want to say expert at this, and I realize that nobody is, but
right.
It's just like it's a work in progress constantly. It's something that you're constantly doing and reminding yourself to do, and that is to focus on things for yourself and sort of be selfish and make sure that you're doing the things that you want to do, and that's hard to do because there's always someone else to consider and think about. And I know that I probably don't do it enough, but I need to go out and be with friends by myself on occasion. We need to go out together. We need to take trips. We need to make even the medical journeys that we have to take, try to make them social events.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not all medical and visiting doctors, but visiting friends and relatives, trying to attend family gatherings and affairs and gatherings and affairs of friends, things that we recently went to NIH. We spent last week at NIH, but not only did we visit the doctors and do the exams, but we visited friends, we visited relatives, we spent the night with a relative, and that made it. We toured around Washington, D.C. We went on an adventure with the subway with the wheelchair.
Yes.
And that worked out well.
Good.
And on previous occasions down at NIH, we've taken the bus down there, and we've been on the subway. So it's sort of been enjoyable. Alfida has cousins in the area, I have friends in the area, and we try to visit them. And we try to plan when we're going so that we can have some fun while we're there.
That's great. So do what you need to do and add as much fun as you can pack into it.
Yeah.
And you said you also participate in a support group.
I have participated in a cancer care support group. I'm not participating in it now and haven't in quite some time, but this was several years ago. I became a member of a cancer care support group and listened to other people's story who had cancer in their families and mostly spouses. And my story is not the worst.
Right.
It's far from it, so I guess in being there I felt a little fortunate.
Yeah, when you hear other people's stories, you realize your story is not the worst one in the world.
Yes.
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, given a choice, you pick the one you've got rather than some other one. So sometimes it's good to hear other people's war stories.
Yes, and see how that they deal with it and the fact that they're still up and they're doing things and they're still excited about being here, being alive and being able to do things. And they are caretakers and they're taking care.
Yeah. And taking care of someone you love is what marriage is all about, really. And we never know when we sign on for the journey exactly how it's going to go. We think we do. We make our plans, but then we always get fouled up in some way. I remember you saying once, too, that if we live long enough, every one of us is going to be a caregiver and or a patient.
Yeah. And I believe that, and I've ran into so many people who told me stories that it's just it's the way it goes. And one disease that seems to be more prevalent these days, or maybe because I'm meeting more people with it because I may be a little older now, is Alzheimer's.
Right.
At a much younger age. And I have recently participated in an Alzheimer's support group, because we do have a relative who's fairly young, not 60 yet, and who's afflicted with Alzheimer's.
Hmm.
And in that support group, I've met other people who have spouses who are under 60, and yet they have Alzheimer's, and they've had to stop work. And it's been in families where the wife has had to get a job. The husband has to stop work. While he has Alzheimer's, he doesn't qualify for any kind of home care. And so he's home all day by himself while she has to go to work.
Mm.
And there's a lot of frustration there because she's worried about, well, what's he doing while I'm at work? And what's he doing? Is he okay? And what's he doing? Is he doing something?
Right, not just vegetating or sleeping all day.
Yeah.
Right.
And so it's kind of a, what do you worry about? And what do you encourage him to do? Do you encourage him to be active and do something? Or do you encourage, well, you don't want to encourage him to vegetate. So that seemed to have been really hard.
You mentioned, too, that caregivers need to be willing to ask for help.
Yes.
And you've gotten good support, you said, from other members of your family.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, on my job, I occasionally travel. And during those times, I would need someone to come and spend the night. And my mother-in-law was always willing, and my wife's sister have always been willing, and so that's been good. in traveling, it would be good when possible, when we go to certain family gatherings, to have the support of someone to travel with and to help out. And they've always been good with that, and I've relied recently on my own brother and sister to help us out while traveling. And so family has been good. Alfida also has some friends who occasionally, a girlfriend of hers, who occasionally will come by and will spend the night and will take her to, she also belongs to a sorority, and the sorority has affairs. And some of them are for, as they say, sorors only, women only who belong in the fraternity, sorority.
Right, right.
And so they would take her. And I'm sure that's very good for her that she can go.
Get a girl's day out.
Yeah. Just like I'm grateful when, and we now have another good caretaker, that is home care attendant. And she will come not only during the hours that she's assigned, but when requested. If we need additional help or if we need her to spend the night, she will.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be on the occasion when I might go out. But during the times on my job when I was traveling, I could depend on one of those people to be around, to be with her overnight.
And you can't just assume that they'll automatically know what you need. You have to be very precise about exactly what you need them to do, right?
Yes. There have been times when that might involve cooking food or just be around for a certain period of time or to be around overnight.
Right, and make space to recharge your own batteries, whatever that is. Some people need to be with other people to recharge their batteries. Some people need time alone to do that. But to be explicit about what your own needs are and not to be ashamed of asking for that.
Yes, that's a very definite need, although one has, I guess, has to think about that and really know what you need.
Right. Some of us were brought up to think that that was very selfish to do that. But it's important to be just a little bit selfish in a situation like this, because if you're not healthy and willing to be where you are, nobody's going to be happy. So you need, as a caregiver, to take good care of yourself as well. I often think of on the airplanes, you know, that when they do that little talk, they always say, if those oxygen masks come down, put your own oxygen mask on first before you help anybody else. And I know one of my grandsons turned to me and said, why wouldn't you help me first? And I said, well, you know, if I pass out, then I can't help you at all. So it is important for us to take care of ourselves so that we can be there for the people around us who need us.
Yes.
What else would you like to say to people about how to live as a caregiver?
Get in touch with your own spirituality, whatever that is, and rely on it. Get in touch with it. Be centered and focused on it. And allow it to help you.
Yes, and I know you do that very well. I really have to say that I admire you very much, and I think you and Alfida have done a great job as a team sustaining your healthy relationship through sometimes some difficult times. So thanks very much for sharing your thoughts.
Thank you. You're welcome. I hope I was able to get some thoughts out.
Oh, you did great. As usual.
Fred and I will be back in just a moment to talk a little bit more about the negotiation process and how the patient and the caregiver can work together as a team to make it a happier experience for both of them. It's something I think that Fred and Althea do particularly well. They have a very strong family unit, the two of them, and with the rest of their family members around them. They do a great job. So stay with us. We'll talk a little bit more about that after these messages. Please go to powerfulpatient.org on the internet. You'll find the program guide for this show, and even more important, we'll ask you to donate some money to help bring back this program another day, and also to fund additional research on cancer. We'll be announcing this year's grant recipients in June. If you could donate just $10, we would have enough for another grant. Thank you so much. You can see from this story how very important it is to learn more about how we can stop tumors without needing to do it surgically, because even the best doctor with the best instrumentation runs a risk every time they approach your spinal cord. And if we could avoid surgery, if we had a drug that could shrink the tumors without surgery, then we'd have a much better chance of fixing the tumor and not damaging the spinal cord. So the human impact of cancer of all descriptions, and especially of tumors of the brain and spinal cord, is vast, and it really changes people's lives. So won't you help us fix that problem? So here we are back again, talking some more with Fred Johnson about his own experiences as a caregiver and what he's learned along the way.
And I know that the folks in South Africa very much appreciated your willingness to share that, because some of them were very concerned about their spouse or the mother of their children, how they were dealing with having a child with the disease or having a spouse with this disease. And it was really important for them to hear from you these kinds of thoughts so that they could help support their spouse. Yeah, because it takes the two people working at it. You can't do it alone. And if your spouse, you know, as you said with Alzheimer's, the spouse is not always there to really work with. When their mental faculties are gone, they really can't be a partner. So then you need to find that sustenance in a support group or in a church or somewhere else. You mentioned you've got someone with Alzheimer's in the family. Is there where do the supports come for that spouse?
Well, I think it comes from the family or the community, I would say, and it's actually been going on for a long time. This person had a pretty high-level executive position within an agency here in the city, and actually had, you know, symptoms of Alzheimer's for the past 2 years while they were still working. And their coworkers kind of were in conversation with them and the wife, and they understood that the person had a problem, and they kind of supported him at work and kind of just took over for him. He was picked up from his house every day, driven to work and driven home, and there was someone in the office who would oversee everything that he did. And they kind of just helped to manage him for the last 2 years of his employment. And upon his retirement, then the family, he has a couple of sons, one of which is probably around just about all the time, and another part of the time, and some neighbors and friends and other family members. I spent a great deal of time with him, and so did several other people in the family. So she really relies on her children and friends and his coworkers.
Right. And it's very important that the caregiver not burn out, so these supports are essential. What else would you want to say to patients? How can a patient make it easier on their caregivers?
I think by if it's a caregiver, who, particularly who's a spouse, they have to recognize that I know in my situation I cannot do everything without the aid of their occasions and things that I'm invited to or that we are invited to. Most recently, there was a writers' conference in Brooklyn, and the conference expanded for a weekend. And this is over the last 2 years. Now, it starts on a Friday, ends on a Sunday, and there are a couple of receptions that we're invited to. We're not able to go together to all of those events.
Mm-hmm.
So some of those I have to go to by myself. And she needed to understand that, well, she can't be a part of that. And one of them we were able to go to together.
Right.
But when we do, there's more time involved in getting there and getting back and seating arrangements and things of that nature. So she has to realize that I have to do some things on my own and give me the space to do it. And more than that, encourage me to do things on my own.
Right.
And then she has to, for the things that we're going to do together, recognize that that more planning is needed and that I can't think of everything that she might need. We're going to South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
There's something that she might need that I'm not going to think of.
Right.
So she has to be cognizant enough to think of that and tell me so that we can plan for that. We went on a cruise last year, and I wasn't of the impression that she could take her motorized wheelchair on the boat. I thought it would be more of a problem. But actually, it was a good thing, but she needed to research that and find that out whether or not that would work or not.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that I even thought about. I just thought manual wheelchair, and in order to get off the boat, and if you had to get in another vehicle or something, that you would need the manual wheelchair. And even in going to South Africa, she thought about the other wheelchair, and we did do the research and found out it just wasn't viable to get a motorized chair.
Right.
And a vehicle to get around. And but certain things like that, she'll know, she'll think more about what her needs are than I can.
Right, and she has more time to spend on the phone doing that kind of research than you do because you're off working or whatever.
Yes.
Right.
And she's just more, she needs to be just more attuned to it.
Right, exactly.
Because there are times when we go out, we'll be invited someplace, and she needs to ask the question, well, is that accessible?
Right. But probably just the open negotiation between the two of you is one of the things that helps to keep the air clear. Because if you don't speak things, if they become bottled up resentments, then that's a bad idea on both sides.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, you're very welcome.
Yeah, thanks for all you add to the VHL community. And I'm very glad I know you.
We're glad we know you, and thank you for all that you do. And I remember meeting you many years ago.
Right.
And it was such a good thing. And I must say, I've noticed there's been quite a change in Althea since we've met, and she's been involved with the VHL Family Alliance.
Thanks.
It's been another world for her, or another mission that she's become involved in. And
yeah, and she's often said to me, you know, how much it adds to her life. I think it's very important for a person who carries the medical burdens that she does to have a job, so to speak, to have an outlet, to have interesting activities that are meaningful to her where she feels she can make a contribution. And she definitely does make a contribution every day.
So let me tell you a little bit more about Althea's job at the VHL Family Alliance. First of all, she is the chairperson of our hotline committee, and she coordinates the committee of ladies who answer the telephone and talk with patients. They're all people who have VHL, and what we've learned through the hotline is when someone calls in and discovers that they're talking with someone else who has this condition, that alone is a major gift, and people will talk for half an hour or more on that first call and really share experiences because they know that they're talking with someone else who has the VHL condition. So she adds a very great deal and shares of herself constantly, and that is a wonderful contribution to our organization. In addition to that, she also volunteers at the International Center for the Disabled and helps with tips for cooking from a wheelchair. She helps other people learn how to get around their kitchen and take advantage of the tools and gadgets that are available to make life easier cooking from a wheelchair. So these are just a few of the ideas that she has come up with, and she plans not only fun for herself, but also fun for herself and her husband together, so that they have things that they can do as a couple and enjoy life together. So put fun in your life and be good to your caregiver, and as a caregiver, be good to yourself. And hopefully you and your partner will be able to do a wonderful job together, making life the best it can be. We can't always live the ideal life that we had hoped for. We all have a hand of cards, as it were, that we need to deal with. And just play that hand the best you possibly can. Live life to the fullest, enjoy, and be a powerful patient. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next time with more ideas on spinal cord injury and also what's called traumatic brain injury. A traumatic brain injury is sort of a bruise, if you will, on your brain. And it's not as obvious as when you bruise or break a leg or something like that. You don't put a cast on it, but it can have some very devastating effects. And sometimes it does impede your ability to use your limbs. So there's some interesting new devices on the market. We're going to talk about a few of them from time to time. Next week, we're going to talk with a company called Bioness. This is the first in a series of introductions that we're going to do of innovative devices that might speed the physical therapy process. This one addresses problems following stroke, spinal cord injury, or traumatic brain injury. Anything that might make it difficult for you to move your hands or feet in the way that you need them to move. And this device tries through electronic stimulation to retrain the nerves. You'll hear more about that next week. I hope that you will be good to yourself, be well, and be a powerful patient. See you next week.